open the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for Thursday, March 5th, 2009. We have three bills on our agenda today, and I'm going to take them in order and start with Senate Bill 485. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 485 and ask our committee administrator, Lori, to give us a summary of the bill, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 485 prohibits the change of a subscriber's Internet service provider unless the person changing the provider clearly discloses the effect on the subscriber's cost per service. It requires anyone changing the provider to obtain and verify unambiguous order for the change. It makes an unauthorized change of the Internet service provider an unlawful trade practice. It requires the ISP to show valid verification of subscriber change order upon inquiry or in the context of an investigation.
Thank you so much. And this is Senator Przanski's bill, but I know he said he couldn't be here today, but we have David Work. Do you want to come on up, please? If you'll please state your name for the record and then give us your testimony, please.
David Work. I'm an Internet service provider in Cottage Grove, Oregon. I've been an Internet service provider since 1996. In 2002, we became a reseller for Quest DSL services. The way that DSL services work is Quest provides the connectivity from the customer's house to their central office or phone switch, and then they pass off the Internet connectivity to an Internet service provider. In some cases, that Internet service provider is Quest. In other cases, it's an independent service provider, such as my company. The reason that we requested this action is because Quest has a history of slamming customers from an independent service provider to their service. The way that this happens is a customer may call Quest to request a speed change, or they may call Quest to request a new modem, or they may call Quest to have some other change made to their service that really has nothing to do with their Internet service provider, that second half of the provisioning of their circuit. Quest will many times simply change their ISP from us or whoever the independent provider is to their service, be it MSN or Quest.net. And it happens frequently. It happens and causes a great deal of problem for us as an Internet provider, because we usually spend hours on the phone with Quest trying to get the problem straightened out. Generally speaking, it causes a disruption in service to the consumer. In the cases that I'm talking about, the consumer does not know that their Internet provider has been switched, and so their Internet service stops working. They don't know unless we know. So we usually get notified the day that the service is disconnected, which means that we usually don't have any time or any ability to correct the problem before that Internet service is disconnected. We've had conversations with Quest over and over and over again about this. They claim that it is not their policy, but it happens so frequently that I almost think that it's an unwritten rule within Quest to switch Internet providers whenever they can. Beyond that, I'm not sure what to tell you. I have an example that I unfortunately did not know I needed to bring 25 copies of before I made the trip up here from Cottage Grove. But I have an example of a situation that happened today, as it were. A customer of ours, we received a speed change notice and a disconnect at the same time. We've not been able to get a hold of the customer yet to verify that they didn't wish to change service providers, but because of our relationship with that customer and our knowledge of their account, I'm about 99.999% certain that they did not request an ISP change, that it was done by Quest without the customer's permission or knowledge, and it will result in an increase in cost to them as well because of the circumstances of their account.
It's my understanding that there's some copies being made
of
that. Is that correct?
Yes, and I do apologize. I didn't know I needed to bring
that. That's all right. I'm going to open it up to questions at this time, if that's all right. Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so I understand how this works, so I live in Cottage Grove. I come to you, and you're my Internet service provider. Who bills me at that point?
There's actually two bills in our case. We don't have a relationship with Quest for billing, so a portion of the bill comes from Quest, and a portion comes from us. So Qwest is actually providing the service that they provide is a connectivity from the customer's house to the Qwest phone switch, and that's what they're being billed for. It's how the, it comes on the same line as their dial tone comes on.
Can I follow up?
Please.
So once they're, as you described, slammed, then the Qwest or whatever provider bill goes up to what would have been your bill and their bill added together or more? Is that what you're saying? That's how the customer pays more? So you, right now they have two bills, right? And they end up getting one bill from whatever internet.
To be fair, generally speaking, Qwest's combined bill is going to be less than ours. But Qwest is a 14-state company with lots of resources, and they have deals that they make with companies like MSN. They can offer services for cheaper than we can. But we provide other services to the community that Qwest doesn't provide. We support local nonprofits, and our money circulates locally, and we employ local people and so on. But that's usually not why we have customers. They know that it costs them more to be with us and with Qwest and with us as their provider. They know that. In the case of this one particular customer, someone else is paying part of their bill. So when they switched to go back to Qwest, they're going to be responsible for the entire part of their bill. They actually don't know that. They don't know that someone is paying our part of their bill. So that's why I know that they didn't do this on purpose, because their bill will go up.
Okay. Thank you.
Normally that wouldn't happen.
And we did receive a copy of this. Do you want to explain this and kind of walk
through? Oh, sure. And I didn't keep a copy for myself.
Oh,
I know what it is. No, it's okay. I know what they are.
Okay.
The one that's labeled number one is the speed change notice. We get an email anytime someone contacts Qwest and asks for a change in their service. So that's what number one is. It's just a speed change notice. It's nothing more than that. Number two is a disconnect notice. And you'll notice that it came today, and it's due today. So the customer probably contacted Qwest 3 days ago to make this change. Thank you. They probably contacted Qwest on Friday to order a speed change. We don't find out about it until today, and then there's nothing we can do about it to avoid a service disruption, because it's already happened. Their service is already disconnected because we got the number two email that basically says that they're disconnected. We get no other notification from anybody unless the customer contacts us and says we're switching, which didn't happen in this case.
Other questions? Anyone else on the committee have any questions? No?
I do have one other thing.
Okay, go
right
ahead.
To suggest a possible amendment to this bill. Part of the issue when this happens is that it can take a long time for Qwest to react. We have to be involved in it. The customer has to know the right questions to ask. I would like to suggest that if it is a case where they've been slammed without the customer's permission, that something be included in this bill that requires them to react almost instantaneously, perhaps within an hour of being notified that this is the case, that they wish to switch back to their original provider, that it happen rapidly. Otherwise, Qwest takes their sweet time. And I don't know if this is true with other service providers or not. But that would be, I think, the thing that would most minimize the effect of this kind of egregious situation on the customer, is to have it be remedied almost immediately. They have the ability to do that. It's just a real problem to get them to actually do it.
Thank you. We have noted that. Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 485? If not, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 485 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 489. And, Lori, if you'll please give us the summary of that bill, I'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 489 gives a health benefit plan enrollee a private right of action against an insurer if the insurer agrees in the plan to be bound by an independent review organization decision, and then the insurer fails to comply with the decision. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage, and the committee has a fiscal statement issued that is connected to the new SMS right before you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. And we have Arden Olson. You want to come on up, Arden? Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Arden Olson. I'm a lawyer. I practice in healthcare, although I'm not actually representing a particular client in the sense that any of my clients are currently subject to this bill or troubled by it. What happened that caused me to suggest to Senator Prezansky that maybe something needs to be clarified here goes like this. I have a case that involved a case that went through the IRO process. For those of you who may not be familiar with it, the statutory scheme provides for independent review organizations certified by the Department of Consumer and Business Services in cases of health coverage. And the carriers can elect to be governed by them, to be bound by the decision of those external review organizations, called IROs for short, or not. And the statute provides some remedies in either case. In the case where the health plan does not, well, does determine that it will be bound, if it fails to be bound, then the department can issue penalties if it doesn't follow through with that promise. The statute before you, which is 743-864, is at least cryptic, and one of the things that maybe someone needs to consider, depending on whether anybody else has concerns about this bill, is whether it should be clarified. It provides, as it currently reads, that if you do not, if the plan elects not to be bound, then they can be sued if they don't do what they didn't promise to do. And I'm a lawyer, I've been doing this for 30 years, I had a very hard time understanding what that means. you make a promise, but you don't make a promise to do something, but you can be sued for something not specified by the statute under circumstances where every person who's a potential plaintiff has a contract or an ERISA plan capable of enforcement either in the state courts or in the federal courts, as the case may be. And so the question is what that means. Let's take you back to the case I started to tell you about. In my case, someone went to the IRO, and the IRO confirmed the plan's denial of benefits. Okay. So then the member sued in federal court, happened to be an ERISA case, and it seemed to me, this is a little off the topic, but it seemed to me that the member, having chosen to be subjected to this process by which the plan was bound, the member should be bound too. That was an arbitration under the Federal Arbitration Act, and so they shouldn't be able to come back again and sue in federal court. So I made a motion to that effect before the judge. It was denied recently on other grounds, but that's not really the point of this story. In 30 years of practice before the federal courts, the only time a federal judge has issued a preliminary ruling before oral argument on a case was in this case on this point. And in 15 pages, what Judge Jones said in that case was, looks to me like neither party is bound. And the reason that neither party is bound is that this is an alternative enforcement scheme under ERISA. That is, the plan has no choice. It's going to be subjected, whether it does or does not elect to be bound, to a state enforcement scheme that's separate from the federal scheme, so that neither party is bound, so you don't win your judgment on the pleadings motion because you wouldn't have been bound either. And I'm confident that whatever the legislature intended by this statute, that wasn't it. So the upshot of what happened after I pondered this was I mentioned to Senator Prezansky, he can't mean what it means, because what it says, because I don't even know as a lawyer what you can be sued for under this statute. And his response was to file this bill, so I'm here. I've had conversations with a number of people up to today. I chatted with the insurance division the other day, and they seem similarly puzzled by the statute. They seem to agree that maybe the better solution was simply to repeal this particular section of the statute, because if there's a right of action in state or federal court anyway, what do you gain by having this relatively ambiguous section of the statute? And it at least creates ambiguity. I've been given some noise this afternoon from various people that maybe there was some rationale behind this statute, but I'm not sure it took account of the ERISA concern. My suggestion to you this afternoon, and as I say, this is sort of a soft suggestion. This bill came from a sort of a soft suggestion in the sense that nothing terrible is going to happen to anybody that I know if this bill does or does not pass. It just seemed to me as something that needs to be cleaned up in the law. I happened to find it and say it didn't make any sense to me, so maybe it doesn't make any sense to anybody else either. The suggestion, I guess, is to either repeal it or to figure out what it really does mean and clarify it, because it, in its current state, it creates the kind of mischief that happens when lawyers have to spend time in front of judges. The rest of the story on the federal case I'm talking about is, until about 3 days ago, the word I'd gotten from the court was he was intending, because he couldn't figure out what the statute meant, to certify the question of what the statute meant to the Oregon Supreme Court and have them tell him. Now, the process by which the federal court in this district does that requires that the question be circulated to all 12 or 15 judges, and then they all collectively decide whether to do that. They seem to have decided not to do that, but looked pretty likely to me at the time, and it seemed like a colossal waste of time and energy and a diversion in a lawsuit that we just didn't need. So one way or the other, it would be sort of useful to clear this up.
Thank you so much, Arden. I was trying to read between the lines on this, and I think you've either helped or further complicated it. I haven't quite figured that out yet. But I was wondering if perhaps it was a drafting error or something. So are there questions for Arden while he's here? We do have someone else signed up to testify on this, and that's Mike Becker from Regents. So thank you, Arden.
Thank you.
Chair Bonamici and members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. I'm here today to testify in opposition to striking, to making this change as proposed in Senate Bill 489, or even the change that was talked about of striking the entire section. In 2000, a work group was appointed, and I'm a little unclear as to whether it was appointed by the legislature or by the governor or if it just came together on its own. But that work group came together to advance a package of health care reforms around patient protection. And at that time, there was proposed by advocates and the plaintiff's bar that a measure be put on the ballot to create a private cause of action against health plans for failure to follow physicians' requirements or recommendations on what is medically necessary. So this work group came together representing all various stakeholders involved in this issue and negotiated over the course of a year a package, a comprehensive package of patient protection, what became known as the Patient Protection Act. And you'll see in the handouts that I've given you the description that was used in the 2001 legislature in regard to this package of reforms that were agreed to uniformly and unanimously by each of these constituents who came together and worked on this package. And I want to draw your attention to number one and number five on this compromise patient protection measure summary from March of 2001. Sub one describes the external review process that was agreed to as an alternative to creating a direct cause of action against health plans in tort for medical necessity issues. And sub 5 describes the compromise that was agreed to in regard to the right to sue in limited circumstances that were previously described today by Mr. Olson. As proposed in 489, it would be the undoing of this compromise that was struck in 2001 and passed as this package of bills, because what it would effectively do as proposed is subject those health plans who agree to be bound by external review and do not follow external review, not only would they be subjected to these fines from the insurance department that start at $250,000 and go up to $1 million per violation, but they would also be subjected to a tort action. And as it states in sub 5, what this work group came to the conclusion and recommendations in this bill, in this package of reforms, was they agreed to a limited right to sue provision relating to compliance with an external review decision. The right would apply only when a health plan chooses to offer non-binding external review and subsequently refuses to comply with the external review decision in a specific case. Health plans agreeing to be bound by external review decisions would not be subject to any new legal exposure, but would be subject to fines for failing to comply with their contracts. The second document that I've handed out today is something that I pulled off the DCBS website, and it shows the total number of external reviews completed by health plans under the guidance of the department between July 1, 2002 and September 30th, 2006. This is the most current information on the department's website, but it shows you, it shows very effectively that these external review procedures are working, and they are having the intended effect of protecting patients and providing this objective alternative review of these types of medical decisions. So with that, I will close. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. And I have a question. Were you part of this work group in 2001?
I was brought in to the subgroup that was working specifically on this issue, and I was only brought in belatedly when they were having trouble finalizing the final package on this issue. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't there from the start. I was there at the tail end.
And do you know if the ERISA concerns that Mr. Olson mentioned were discussed in this context?
I do not know that. In the types of ERISA issues that he is mentioning, I do know that there were ERISA concerns raised insofar as the direct cause of action for tort against health plans and how that would play out for ERISA plans.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Burdick?
Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if it sounds to me like part of the problem here might just be confusion over what is actually being said, and I'm just wondering if you've had a chance to talk to Mr. Olson about it and see, you know, communicate on maybe you're both trying to go the same direction, because it sounds to me like it's not so much a question of the substance of it, but that just the way it's worded and the confusion.
Chair Bonamici and Senator Burdick, we spoke very briefly for just a minute or two right before this committee hearing started, so we weren't able to finish that discussion. And I do want to continue that discussion with Mr. Olson. Our concern from a health plan is, again, undoing this package of protections that was so delicately negotiated over such a lengthy period of time, just undoing it because there seems to be not an understanding of what brought us to this point.
Thank you. Senator George, do you have a question? Anyone else?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosenberg.
Thanks. And I do remember this because I think those of us that were in the legislature voted on this, I guess, in the 2001 session is what I remember. But I guess my question to you is typically, I mean, it's helpful to see the statistics about how these reviews are working, but typically are insurance companies, or yours in particular, participating in this and agreeing to be bound by the decision, or participating but not agreeing to be bound, or just not participating? Do you know what the industry standard is?
Chair Bonamici and Senator Rosenbaum, all health plans must participate. The insurance department contracts with these external IROs, and any time there is a triggering event, which is if you look in Oregon Statute 743-857, these disputes will potentially kick to the IRO anytime there's a dispute relating to an adverse decision by the insurer in one or more of the following areas: whether a course or plan of treatment is medically necessary, whether a course or plan of treatment is experimental or investigational, or thirdly, whether a course or plan of treatment that the enrollee is undergoing is an active course of treatment for the purposes of continuity of care. So those triggers automatically kick it into external review if the member requests the external review. My understanding is that when this statute was put in place and the rules were written, there was only one health plan in the state that agreed not to be bound by the external review. And that agreement to be bound or not be bound must be set forth expressly in the contract and very plainly for the member to see. I don't know whether that particular health plan is still agreeing not to be bound, and or whether other plans have subsequently made that decision. But for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, we have always agreed to be bound by these decisions.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair, just looking at these statistics, it's showing just 300, a little more than 300 of these reviews being done in about a 3.5-year period, which I don't know whether that rate has picked up since 2006, but if that's all the disputes that are being submitted to this process, there must be way more disputes about medically necessary and covered services. So it would just look from these numbers like it's not particularly encompassing most of the disputes that it could be.
Chair Bonamici and Senator Rosenbaum, I would actually take a little different view of it. Health plans all have very effective review procedures inside the plan before it ever gets to external review. And most of these disputes are resolved by the medical physicians inside the plans reviewing those determinations and making a decision. And in most of those instances, the member is satisfied with that decision and never kicks it to external review. So it's not like a decision is made and it automatically goes. The plans deal with this through their medical directors very effectively internally. And if you would like, we could bring physicians, our physician staff in to talk about our internal review process on these types of decisions.
Yeah, I'm not questioning that there are internal reviews. It just seems unlikely to me that there are fewer than 100 Oregonians a year who are not totally happy with the covered services in their medical plan. That, and maybe for you that's the case.
And these statistics, these are for all health plans. I'm sorry,
right.
Chair Bonamici, Senator Rosenbaum.
Other questions? Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on Senate Bill 489? Well, I'm going to ask, since you offered Mr. Becker and Mr. Olson, if you could have a further conversation. And I know since Mr. Olson mentioned that he had been speaking with the insurance division, it would be helpful if you got them in as well. And then we can follow up and see if we can come to a solution. Thank you very much. Anyone else? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 489 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 539 and ask Lori to summarize the bill for us, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 539 exempts the Tort Liability and Property Damage Self-Insurance Program from the insurance code if that program is established by two or more affordable housing entities. The bill defines affordable housing entity, and there are dash ones that are before you that include a couple of changes. One is to change the and tort liability and property damage becomes tort liability or property damage, and then the other change essentially clarifies the definitions of affordable housing and affordable housing entity. There is a no fiscal impact statement before you as well.
Thank you very much. And we have a panel of James Hackett, James Kennedy, and Phil Donovan, please. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Housing Authority Risk Retention Pool, and I also represent the Oregon Housing Authorities. Here in support of Senate Bill 539, and would like to just quickly provide an overview of the bill's intent and public policy benefits. Housing authorities have enjoyed stable, low-cost insurance coverage that keeps rents affordable for seniors, disabled, working families, people who are just simply facing life's challenges. This insurance coverage that's so cost-effective is possible because housing authorities in Oregon, Washington, California, and Nevada created the Housing Authority Risk Retention Pool in 1987. HARP in Oregon operates under an exemption from the insurance code. And the problem that we are now encountering is that some affordable housing properties are ineligible for HARP coverage, and those include tax credit partnerships and nonprofits developing affordable housing. And what Senate Bill 539 would do would extend HARP coverage to tax credit partnerships and nonprofit corporations so that they can have stable, cost-effective insurance with an insurer that is committed and has expertise in affordable housing. A few quick points of interest. First off, California and Washington already allow self-insurance pools for housing authorities and nonprofit affordable housing developers. Secondly, I've distributed to you all a letter from the Oregon Opportunity Network, which represents nonprofit affordable housing developers and their support for this legislation. I also want to let you know that we've run this legislation past the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and they do not have reason to oppose the legislation. And we have shared the bill with representatives of the insurance industry, and to the best of my knowledge, they are okay with this request. So before fielding questions, what we kind of hope to do with this panel is allow James Hackett, who is the executive director of the Lynn Benton Housing Authority and also serves on the Housing Authority Risk Retention Pool Board, and he can talk just real briefly about the evolution that we've seen in affordable housing that kind of leads to the request that you see before you. And then Jim Kennedy is counsel to the Housing Authority Risk Retention Pool, and he is here to provide a quick explanation of how the bill is constructed and to describe the friendly amendment that you have in the dash ones. If it's okay by you, Chair Bonamici, I would turn it over to James.
Thank you, Phil. And we do have your written testimony, so if I can ask you to summarize your testimony, we will, rather than read it, we will keep the written copies for our records and appreciate your being here. So, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is James Hackett. As Phil said, I'm the executive director of Lynn Benton Housing Authority, and I'm also on the board of HARP. The Lynn Benton Housing Authority down in Albany, Oregon, is a fairly small housing authority, and we manage around 200 units of housing. And of those, 48 were able to insure under the HARP program. The others are owned by tax credit partnerships. And tax credits are a federal tax credit that is used to develop affordable housing. And the way those work, we have to create a limited partnership to own that development. And because it's owned by a private limited partnership, a private entity, it's not a public entity, and therefore can't be insured under HARP. So we're looking to expand the ability of HARP to cover or insure those properties that we've already developed and want to insure with the same kind of coverage we have with HARP, which is very stable in premium, a very broad coverage that covers risks that are associated with providing affordable housing. And I've summarized it very shortly, and I'll pass it on. If you have more questions, I'll ask.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
Chair Bonamici and members of the committee, my name is Jim Kennedy. I'm an attorney practicing with Kennedy & Kennedy in Portland. I have represented Housing Authority's Risk Retention Pool, or HARP as we refer to it, since its inception in 1987. As indicated, HARP operates under an exemption from the Oregon Insurance Code, specifically ORS 731.036, subsections 4 and 5. It is also subject to statutory requirements enacted in the 2005 legislative session that are found at ORS 30.282. HARP operates in a four-state territory, and there are a variety of different statutory requirements and regulatory provisions in those states. Those other states are Washington, California, and Nevada. Very simply, what we're trying to do with this bill is to create a new exemption for the types of affordable housing entities that are creating affordable housing in the state of Oregon and in the other states in which HARP operates. We are attempting to provide a very narrow exemption from the insurance code. We do that in a couple of ways. The first way is to limit the participants that can participate in an affordable housing insurance pool. And those are set forth in the bill starting at line 27 on page 3. The types of entities that can participate in an affordable housing insurance pool are a housing authority, a nonprofit corporation that provides affordable housing, or a partnership, whether general or limited, or a limited liability company that both provides affordable housing and is affiliated with a housing authority or a nonprofit corporation that provides affordable housing. The bill describes the type of affiliation that is required for a partnership or a limited liability company, and that's found at lines 35 to 41 of the bill. Basically, it's a four-part test in terms of the relationship between the housing authority or nonprofit corporation on the one hand and the partnership or limited liability company on the other hand. We are proposing two amendments to the bill. The first amendment would enlarge the definition of affordable housing entity very slightly to include an agency or instrumentality of a housing authority. And the purpose for this is to give housing authorities more flexibility in structuring their affordable housing deals with tax credits and nonprofits. The other advantage of this change is that it will allow HARP to obtain reinsurance or provide financing to a new affordable housing insurance pool. The other thing we're doing with the amendments, and those are in this amendment is found at lines 4 to 6, is to define affordable housing. And we have defined it as a housing project in which some of the dwelling units may be purchased or rented with or without governmental assistance on a basis that is affordable to individuals of low income. This definition would give the tax credit limited partnerships and nonprofits that are developing affordable housing the flexibility they need to be covered by an affordable housing insurance pool. I have submitted today to you written testimony from Bill Gregory, the executive director of HARP. He is unable to be with us today because he is ill, and in his testimony he describes the need for affordable housing insurance pools, how they would operate, and also HARP's intention to organize an affordable housing insurance pool should this legislation be enacted. Thank you very much for your attention, and we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Are there questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Just a technical one. You mentioned two amendments you want. Are they both incorporated in the dash one amendment?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any questions? No questions? Thank you very much for your presentation. We have no one else here to testify. Anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 539? So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 539 and open a work session on Senate Bill 539.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 539 with the amendments dated 3309.
Senator George moves the dash one amendments into Senate Bill 539. Any objection? Would Senator Girard like a roll call vote?
No, I pass on that.
Any objection? If not, the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 539 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 539 as amended with the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No discussion? Can we have a roll call vote, please, Ann?
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator
Girard? Yep.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Bonamici?
Aye. Senate Bill 539 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senate Bill 539, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
No.
And The chair will carry the bill. Thank you. Thank you, committee. And that concludes our business for today. I'll close the committee. Thank you.
I am never going to live it down.